This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The last time kindergarten teacher M. Indira Gandhi saw her youngest daughter was more than 6 years ago. The daughter, Prasanna Diksa, was less than a year old when ex-husband Muhammad Ridwan Abdullah unilaterally converted her and her two older siblings to Islam in 2009. Last month, the Court of Appeal reversed a landmark 2013 High Court decision which annulled these conversions, ruling them unconstitutional. In the studio with me today to discuss the Court of Appeal's decision is lawyer Fari Azad. Welcome to the show, Fari.
Hello.
So I understand that you're fresh from court. You know, any news that's hot off the presses that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, I just came from the federal court decision on Deepa's custody matter and also the recovery order matter, where the federal court basically what they've, well, they didn't decide it. They basically endorsed previous positions taken by the federal and Supreme Courts to say that basically a converting spouse would still have to resolve their divorce and all the ancillary matters related to it, such as custody, maintenance, and all that in the civil courts. So the position is finally, hopefully, made very, very clear now that, look, if you're converting to Islam, it doesn't mean you can just abdicate all your obligations under your civil marriage before.
For full disclosure, what's your involvement with this case?
I was counsel for at the appellate level for these cases, for both Deepa and Indra. Indra, I started right from High Court.
And this is a question that I tend to ask lawyers when they come in, but I'm always curious about this. So when you say hopefully the position is made clear, I assume that we're talking about, you know, because so much of case law is based on precedent and, you know, yes, precedent set in other cases. What does precedent actually stand for in our courts? You know, can somebody really refer to that and say, well, because of case A, thus case B should be judged in the same manner?
Yeah. Precedent is, it's how the court maintains order over its judgments. Right. So, for example, you have different levels of court. So in Malaysia, you have what you call the subordinate courts, which are the magistrates and the sessions courts. And then you have what you call the superior courts, which are the High Court, the Court of Appeal and the Federal Court. Now, at each level, their decisions binds the courts below. So, for example, High Court decisions will bind a sessions court decision. So, for example, if High Court says a sessions court cannot make this decision, right, a sessions court would be bound by that decision, High Court decision. That's what we would call precedent. And they have to follow it, right? The technical term for it is stare decisis.
Coming back to the case at hand, Indira married her husband, K. Padmanabhan, in 1993. He converted to Islam on March 11, 2009. When did they divorce?
Oh, I don't know the exact date. Okay. Yeah. But the divorce was made after she went to the civil courts.
And before we go into the Court of Appeals decision, could you briefly summarize the Ipoh High Court ruling in 2013?
There are two angles to that case. One was what we call the administrative law angle, and the other is the constitutional angle. Now, the administrative law angle is very straightforward and simple. We are basically saying, look, to be converted to a Muslim, there are provisions. These provisions are found in the Administration of Islamic Law Enactment, which sets out the procedures for conversion. So the administrative law position is very straightforward. It's you did not comply with procedure, therefore this conversion was not lawful. So that was the administrative law argument. The constitutional argument was hinged more on the Indra's right to be able to decide her child's religion. And the basic argument there was basically by saying, by allowing only her husband to convert, that kind of nullified her rights as a parent. She wasn't given rights to be heard. And what the High Court judge also decided there was to give a different interpretation to the word parent. He said parents includes both parents. It doesn't include one.
Six parties appealed against that High Court victory. What was the gist of their appeal? What were the issues?
The gist of their approach and their issues is basically the same in most of them. Muslim, Sharia court. It's very simple. So for them, if it's anything relating to Islam, civil court does not have jurisdiction, it must necessarily go into the Sharia court. That is their view of things.
Do Sharia courts have civil jurisdictions, as alluded to in the judgment?
I think it's difficult to answer the question that way. I'll answer it this way. The Sharia courts, their jurisdiction is confined only when all parties are Muslim and the subject matter is family or personal Islamic law. That is the extent of their jurisdiction. So to say civil jurisdiction, no, because they can't hear straightforward debt claims. They can't do bankruptcies. They can't do winding up. So I say that is civil and they can do nothing, none of that.
Just to kind of clarify this entirely,
sure,
then, if the validity of Indira's children's conversion falls within the jurisdiction of the Sharia court, can she seek redress for her kids there as a non-Muslim herself?
Of course not. Of course not. Because she can turn up in court, I mean, physically, right? They can hear her physically. But really, the Sharia court can do nothing because she's a non-Muslim. So, yes, you know, in actual fact, they can listen to her, they can talk to her. But when they want to make an order that binds her, it can't. It just cannot.
It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it just doesn't work that way.
Moving forward from the High Court, what are the implications of the Court of Appeal's latest ruling on unilateral conversions?
I would say if it's Islamic, it's not going to go into the civil courts. That is really the effect because the majority rejected the administrative argument and basically said... No, they are Muslim, so they have to have that resolve in the Sharia. Never mind how they became a Muslim, whether the procedures were properly met. I think they seem to think these things are not significant.
It's so, in other words, it's just a point of, well, you're a Muslim now, therefore it will fall within this area.
That's right. I mean, they don't, for example, inquire further to say, oh, how did you become a Muslim? Oh, did they put a gun to your head? Or did somebody convert you without your consent? All these things don't seem to have any influence for the civil courts wanting to then make further inquiry into the issue.
This ruling, in reversing the Ipoh High Court's ruling, is of the opinion that the subject matter approach should have been used instead of the remedy approach. What is the difference between the two?
Okay, a remedy approach is basically to decide whether this court has jurisdiction by looking to see whether they can grant the reliefs. Okay, I know that sounds incredibly legalistic. Let me put it another way. The court will have jurisdiction if it can grant you what you ask for, really. Okay, so for example, if you go to the Sharia court and you say, I want a bankruptcy order, right? They'll say, no, you know, we can't grant you that remedy. So it's a bit wider in that sense. Subject matter is strict in a sense, Islam, Sharia. So that's how it's being seen at the moment. Oh, is it an Islamic subject matter? Okay, that's it. Civil court has no more jurisdiction. So that is how the tussle has gone with regards to these inter-religious matters at the moment. But now, in the Deepa case, it was recently confirmed again that, look, it is not. That's not how we look at whether you have jurisdiction or not. You have to go back and look at the legislature. Has it been provided for? Do you have jurisdiction? And it's not something to say, oh, it's Islam, therefore it's Sharia. No, you have to go and look at the enactment itself. Look at the statute itself. Does it say you have jurisdiction? If it says you don't, you just don't. So that is a good move that was decided in the case of Latifa Madzin, which was then confirmed this morning today by the federal court.
Justice Dr. Hamid Sultan Abdul Bakr, the dissenting judge in this 2-1 majority ruling, what did he say in his dissenting judgment?
Basically, he found in favor of our administrative law argument because when we went up to the Court of Appeal, we decided to just run the admin argument, the administrative law argument, not to take up the constitutional argument because then you know, you deal with all the sensitivities that come with that because when you bring in constitutional matters, one, they don't seem to like dealing with those issues. And two, you're going to get into this whole whether civil courts are the superior courts and whether they control the Sharia courts and stuff like that. So we didn't want to get into that. We took a straightforward argument to say, look at the enactment. Was it complied with? No, it wasn't. And he took that and he agreed with that.
He also wrote that Malaysian courts are moving away from constitutional supremacy, as you point out, towards parliamentary supremacy.
Yes.
Could you help us understand what that means? What's that distinction?
Sure. Constitutional supremacy means the constitution is the supreme law, as it declares itself to be. And Malaysia has a federal constitution. So what the constitution does is it sets out the ultimate base on which all our laws are made. And they also provide the parameters of what laws you can make. So that is what is meant by constitutional supremacy. The constitution is the supreme law. Every other law must conform to that federal constitution. Now, parliamentary supremacy actually is more a Westminster concept. Okay. That means parliament is supreme. Parliament can make any act without any limitation. And that is very much the English position because they don't have a written constitution there. So sometimes some of the politicians here get confused with these ideas. They forget we are not a parliamentary supremacy, we're a constitutional supremacy. And parliament cannot make any laws that it likes, right? For example, there are all the fundamental liberties, and all laws must not be in breach of any of those fundamental liberties. Well, that's the theory, lah.
Yeah, that's the part that interests me because, you know, if we're moving away from something that should be our legal backbone, you know, what does that move away look like? How does one move away, you know, from what should be the very basis of the practice of our law?
I think it will portend more confusion. Right. Already there's a lot of confusion both in the public side, the political side. And the problem really stems from the fact that these politicians don't really know what they're talking about when they talk about the law. They don't get legal advice before they make pronouncements in the press. And I think it would be a very, very dangerous thing if we move from that. Because that is not the basis of our country. It is not an act of parliament. That sets the tone for everything. It's the constitution. And the danger in that is, you know, the government would be passing laws without any regard for these safeguards for citizens in the federal constitution. And it's very important that the judiciary does not become complicit with that. And that's why it's very important for them to develop the law on constitutional supremacy, on the limits, on how they apply.
I'm speaking today with lawyer Fahri Azad. Together we're talking about the Court of Appeals ruling on unilateral conversion in the case of M. Indira Gandhi. Up next, we find out what the ruling meant for the religious status of Indira's two other children, as well as its impact on those who are over 18. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, lawyer Fahri Azad. We're discussing the Court of Appeals ruling on unilateral conversion, as we saw in the case of M. Indira Gandhi. So what does the ruling in question mean for the religious status of Indira's two other children?
It means the conversion certificates are still valid and they are Muslims.
The court did say, though, that the case of eldest daughter Tevi Dashni is a non-issue as she recently turned 18 and she can decide her own religion. Mm. Does this mean, then, that she's technically an apostate?
No, I think the use of that term does not sound quite correct because those conversion certificates were quashed for her and were not subject to appeal. So I would say she still remains a Hindu.
She was never a Muslim to begin with.
She was never a Muslim to begin with. I think the law has vindicated her own personal belief in that matter.
Within our legal system, would children within these circumstances be allowed to decide their own religion once they turn 18?
My position is that actually children have the right to decide their religion even under 18. I think that's my reading of the Constitution. But yes, theoretically, a child over 18 has the right under the present law. Unless you're a Muslim, then it's going to be difficult.
Considering the fact that religious laws differ from state to state, do civil courts have jurisdiction to consider the validity of the conversion process? I guess we come back to this point about how did you become a Muslim? You know, under what circumstances and what was that process of conversion like?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Yes, they can inquire into the validity, right? If I say that they can do that if the process was not complied with, okay? Then that process is vulnerable to what we call judicial review. That means the courts can look at it and say, look, the Pandafta Mu'alaf, the registrar of converts, he did not carry out his duties in accordance with the enactment. And therefore, we can say what his administrative act there is invalid. And yes, they can do it notwithstanding the states defer, because really it's merely a comparative exercise of what does the enactment say? Have you done it? That's really what it is.
What does the law say on unilateral conversions to religions other than Islam? I mean, we've been focusing on that because of the context of the case. Mm. But broadly speaking?
Nothing. If you're a non-Muslim, really, the laws here don't care
what you do.
What you do, when you change and all that. They don't. It all starts when you enter Islam here.
So in that case, in contesting unilateral conversions of minors into Islam, how do you prove that knowledge and consent of one parent wasn't given?
Well, you know, you're trying to prove a negative, isn't it? And that's always difficult. All you really have is one oral evidence of the mother to say, no, I didn't do it. And a lack of documentary evidence to say, look, I've not signed or given my approval in any other way.
What would that approval normally consist of? Would it consist of, you know, attendance in some form or a signed document of some kind? Or is it enough for someone to say, yeah, no, she knows?
I don't know. The law doesn't seem to really prescribe it. But I think definitely you would want that documented somewhere.
Can international law principles such as CEDAW and CRC be used as supporting arguments?
Yes, they are referred to more commonly now. And definitely that is something we've been doing in all these cases, because it involves the wives and the children. And that's something we really want to try and make it a practice of the court, right? But aside from CEDAW and CRC, the courts are not very minded to apply other treaties, because I would say CEDAW and CRCs were the one where they actually took active steps to regularize some of the local law to put it into effect. Just a little bit on that, because Malaysia, I don't know whether you know, has a dualist kind of approach. Dualist approach means that, yes, notwithstanding the country has maybe ratified something, they still then have to create domestic law to reflect and import them, as opposed to a monist kind of approach where, okay, once the country has ratified that, it immediately has application to domestic law. So Malaysia is very much of the dualist tradition.
So in other words, we have a space between ratification and actually translating that down to the courts.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. You alluded to Asdeepa's case earlier. How is this case similar or different from this one?
In terms of the factual setting of how it all erupted, it's pretty much the same. You know, Hindu husband not happy with the wife, converts out, converts the kids, tries to grab some of them. So in terms of the factual setting, it's very much the same. I think the only difference really is that in Indra, she went on all fronts. Whereas in Deepa, she did not challenge the conversion.
Coming back to Indra then, can you remind us how the two elder siblings remained with her while the youngest daughter is in the custody of the father?
That was circumstance, really. That was because I think the children were at school or something like that, and he came, he was there, the child was there, he basically grabbed the kid and made for it.
And why wasn't she returned to Indra's custody despite an order from the High Court?
Okay, because this is something a lot of people, members of public, don't understand, that a court order is simply that. It's an order to whichever person to do this. So you would think, yes, as law-abiding citizens, when the court says that, you're supposed to do it.
You right? do what the court tells you to,
You
yeah.
do what the court tells you. You've been ordered. If you don't do it, then you're in contempt. But that's the reason why. That is the problem, like, say, in Viren's case, for example. He has been in contempt of the court since the High Court. The High Court has given the mother full custody over both the children, and all these time he has not given the child back. So actually he's in contempt of court.
What does that mean for a regular citizen? You know, if I'm walking around, you know, just living my life being in contempt of the court, you know, right. How does that impact me?
Okay, it impacts you in a way that, for example, it leaves you open to contempt proceedings being taken against you for being in breach of a court order and being imprisoned for it.
But how often is that carried out?
I don't have numbers, but if matters are big enough in corporate fights, yeah. Such orders are not uncommon.
Okay.
Yes.
There was a directive also from the cabinet in 2009 through former de facto law minister Datuk Sri Nasria Aziz that children of an estranged couple should remain in the religion of the parents at the point of marriage. Is this directive still in effect?
I'm not aware of such directive. Yeah, I know there were rumblings back then, and there were all these what I call gesture and noises to do something about it. But I don't think anything meaningful has happened since then.
What would a directive from the cabinet entail? I mean, in general, if this were to have happened, what does that mean for the rest of us?
It has no effect, really. I mean, he says that, but I don't see anything. I see no impact whatsoever in terms of that directive to the cases that's going on now, how these things are playing out. I see no bearing on it whatsoever.
Constitutional lawyer Sharazan Johan said that amendments in our laws are needed, hence Parliament needs to step in. What's your take on this?
I think laws need to be amended, one. Two, I think education of these laws also has to be in place for the people who are going to decide over these matters as well. Definitely. But I like to think if everybody knew what the law was and applying it sincerely and in the spirit of it, I don't think you need those amendments.
In your view, you know, should amendments be coming? Should amendments be made?
Yes.
What laws would you like to see amended?
Well, for one, I would like it to be very, very clear, although it's been clarified by the federal court today, to basically say that, look, it doesn't matter if you convert out, you still have to resolve your previous marriage in the civil courts and make it very clear that a converting spouse also can file for divorce in the civil courts. That has always been one of the shortcomings of the legislation as it is now, because they said, oh, it's silent insofar as the converting spouse. But really, that's not quite correct either, because there have been decided cases that says, nope, it doesn't matter. Even if it doesn't say it, they still can file, you know. The other one I would also say is you should amend the enactments in the Sharia to basically say, look, if this man comes and asks for custody and conversion matters, they must inquire and say, where's the wife? Does she consent? I think this is very important. And finally, I think there should be, clarification insofar as whether a child can determine their own religion. I think that would I think maybe help solve a lot of the issues. Because the problem right now is that people think that they have control over what their kids believe, when really the situation should be, I think the kids should be allowed to decide for themselves. Yes, you can have control over their religious instruction, but you cannot tell them what to believe. That should be eventually up to them.
When we're saying kids here, I mean, we're referring right now to just under 18.
Yes.
But when you say kids should kind of be given that choice, should be
yes.
allowed to speak for themselves, advocate for themselves, at any age? I mean, there's not much difference
yes.
between someone who's 17 and 18.
Yes.
But there's a gulf of difference between someone who's 5 and
Absolutely.
18.
Absolutely, yes. Where is that line? When do they decide? I think really that's up to them. I mean, because religion, really, it's a personal thing between you and God. You find that moment when you feel enlightened and then you find whatever resonates with you. But you know, for us to be telling them you must believe this and believe that, you know, then how true will that belief be later on? You know, is it a matter of habit or is this something they've committed their heart to? So for that reason, my position is I take the position that no, if they haven't got a religion at that time, let them work it out. Who says you need to know exactly what you believe in at the age of 5 or 18 for that matter?
That's true. Finally, in closing, when was the last time you spoke to Indira?
Some time back, really. Yeah, I mean, I usually come in as counsel for these cases, so we usually don't get too involved with the clients. Sometimes we talk to them, but usually it's the solicitors who will be engaging more with her.
And from a legal point of view, if she loses her appeal at the highest court, what else can she do? What are her options?
Well, you could file a review against the decision, but really chances of that usually are on the very, very slim side. The other way is to just accept and live with it and move on, I suppose, as best you can.
Thank you very much for coming in, Fari. Oh,
my pleasure.
I've been speaking with lawyer Fari Azad about the Court of Appeals ruling on unilateral conversion in the case of M. Indira Gandhi. You have been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.